Welcome to the Good Dog Pod. Join us every other Wednesday when we discuss all things dogs, from health and veterinary care to training and behavior science, as well as the ins and outs of Good Dog and how our platform can help you successfully run your breeding program. Follow us and join Good Dog's mission to build a better world for our dogs and the people who love them.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Good Dog Pod, where we discuss all things related to canine health, research, how Good Dog helps breeders run their breeding programs, and so much more. I'm Dr. Nate Ritter, the staff veterinarian here at Good Dog and your host for this week's episode. I'm really excited to introduce the topic of today's podcast, how genetic health testing works and options for getting the results you need to make better breeding decisions. I'm joined this week by Dr. Halpern, the founder and principal scientist at GenSol. Dr. Halpern has spent over 25 years applying the tools of molecular diagnostics in a number of fields of study. He has a PhD in biomedical sciences and a master's in forensic science from the University of Central Florida and a bachelor's in biology from the Florida Institute of Technology. Dr. Halpern started GenSol Diagnostics in 2014 based on a personal experience with his Australian cattle dog, Dexter. Prior to establishing GenSol, Dr. Halpern worked as a senior scientist at Midwest Research Institute, where he managed projects in areas ranging from forensic science to pathogen detection. Before working with Midwest Research Institute, he served as a laboratory researcher at the Brookfield Zoo Conservation Genetics Laboratory, studying the genetic diversity of wild and captive animals. Dr. Halpern, welcome to the Good Dog Pod.
Thanks, Nate. It's really good to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm sure our community would love to hear about how you became initially interested in this field, and then maybe if you could take us through your educational and professional path that, you know, has led you to your current role.
Sure. Yeah, no problem. Well, we started the company back in 2014, and it was really based off of a personal experience. We had gotten an Australian cattle dog puppy named Dexter, and long story short, he ended up having a genetic condition known as PRCD, where he pretty much would go blind by about the age of 8 to 10, somewhere in there. And we didn't know at the time, the breeder hadn't tested for it. This was back at a time when, you know, a single test was somewhere around $150, typically had to be done on blood. So, you know, it just wasn't cost effective. I'd been in doing molecular biology and diagnostics for probably about 15 years at that point. And I knew that it did not cost that much money to do this kind of testing. So we jumped in and essentially revamped and came up with a system where we could charge, you know, anywhere from about $25 to $40 a test. And I like to think that we kind of revamped the whole industry, because after that, over time, the rest of the industry came down price-wise and sort of brought things into a place where cost wasn't a factor. Because that really was, you know, the issue at hand was it was just too expensive for the average breeder. So we knew that it didn't have to be that way, that, you know, you didn't have to produce dogs with disease, you know, if the price was right and we could provide people with information quick enough so they could make the decisions they needed to make when it came to breeding and healthcare.
Yeah, absolutely. The price discussion is interesting. What do you think that was originally? I know you said due to your experience that didn't
seem to be the price.
Yeah, exactly. Was that animal specific, or what did you find?
It's a combination of things. I think back then, you know, it was harder. The technology was different. We also just innovated. We essentially do things in a very different way that significantly reduces the cost. And I think back then there was also, it just was availability. You know, certain tests were only offered by one company. So there was bit of a monopoly. And essentially, once I think more industries jumped in, it was, you know, standard market forces, it, you know, allowed the price to come down.
Sure, absolutely. So I know we can thank Dexter for GenSol's kind of coming to be. I was wondering if you could speak to us a little bit about founding such a company. I think a lot of people would find that really interesting.
Yeah, sure. We started out small. We're a mom and pop organization, and we started out just built a quick website and started testing. And we just got a really good response from breeders. And we've sort of grown our technology, grown our innovations over the years so that we're constantly trying to improve what we do. We just recently, within the last couple of years, kind of introduced breed-specific panels because we saw a trend in the industry where most places that do this, you know, they just had a broad menu, you know, just choose a test. And I don't think people understood at that time that lots of these mutations that we test for are very breed specific. And it just allowed us to help people make better decisions based on these test results. Because as the industry's grown, we've seen more stuff come in where now you can see, you know, hundreds of tests for a fixed price. And unfortunately, not all those tests, actually, most of those tests typically don't apply to, you know, your breed. And, you know, we find it just causes more confusion or misunderstanding about how to use this information to benefit breeders. And really, it's about dog health is our primary mission here is, you know, we don't want to keep creating dogs with disease when there's another option.
Yeah, absolutely. Besides the kind of breed specific panels and specific tests that you can order individually, what else sets GenSol apart in your opinion?
Well, we are very fast. We typically deliver results in about 24 to 48 hours, which again is due to how we do things. We have a very automated system. There's a little bit of human intervention at the beginning, essentially, you know, getting the swab into the tube and stuff like that. But beyond that, most of it's automated. We typically have results within hours, but due to quality control, we issue those results within about, you know, 24 to 48 hours to allow folks to, again, make those decisions that they need to. Because if you got a litter on the ground, you know, you have a certain period of time, the clock's ticking because you now, you know, you've got pet parents that are waiting. But you need that information quickly. So that was another driving force that, you know, we thought was important. You know, accuracy, we all strive to be accurate. That's sort of goes without saying. And then we just try and be there for people, you know, through customer service. And we've got very knowledgeable people. We're always here to answer questions. That is the other half of this is you can deliver a result, but really the person on the other end needs to know what to do with that result. You know, whether that's a breeder, a pet parent, a veterinarian, and we get contacted by all those groups. They want to know, well, I got my result. What does it mean? You know, what can I do with this? Who should I breed? Who shouldn't I breed? Different health treatments. Some of these diseases you really can't do anything about, but knowing it's coming makes a big difference. Like, for example, with Dexter, just knowing what was coming, we made different choices with this. The way we treated him health-wise and then also kind of thinking ahead to, you know, what the situation would be when he started to lose his eyesight.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a really good point. We have so many people that reach out and, you know, we really try to promote animal health testing and they'll come out and, okay, I did the test. And we're not just doing to do the test, right? You got to take those results and do something with it. I mean, as a veterinarian, I definitely feel that there is as good of an understanding as we could have. And so I think it's a nice segue into talking about the genetic testing itself. So I was wondering if you could cover maybe the basics of genetic health testing. We have, as I'm sure you can imagine, a variety of different experience within our breeders, people that are very knowledgeable, very advanced, and then people that are just starting out. I think we're certainly a place for everyone if you're willing to learn, improve, and do the best you can. And so I think, you know, these conversations are always a little bit tricky just because we want to have something for everybody. Exactly. But starting at the foundation level, I think is always really helpful. So I was wondering if you'd start there.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think one big misconception that we can start out with, the question we get a lot is, does my dog carry the gene for degenerative myelopathy, the gene for brown or chocolate? The thing I don't think people understand is what we're actually testing for is mutations. These are changes in DNA sequence that break or change something that was originally there. So they're not inheriting genes, they're inheriting mutations. And these mutations are typically found by researchers through a lot of hard work and a lot of good scientific research. They not only find these mutations that are responsible for a condition, but the really good studies also link it to the disease as well. That's another trend that we've been seeing is that sometimes there'll be a lot of confusion because certain mutations will pop up in other breeds that were not studied. And it's difficult to say what the outcome is for those other breeds because they were not in the original research. So we're rooted in science. Our company is a science-based company. So we are very careful about what tests we add, what breeds we recommend for those tests, because it's all rooted in science. We either base it off of the basic research that was done or follow-up research, which that's always great too, because sometimes researchers will find a mutation and follow-up research will show that the conclusions were not maybe correct or didn't seem to support what the original researchers found. And the other good resource that we use is breed health committees. Those are really the boots on the ground that, you know, they are getting personal situations where they can see this in their breed. So we use both of those resources to determine which breeds we list for different mutations. We still give our customers lots of flexibility. We do offer breed-specific panels, but we call it build your own panel, or you can take tests out, you can add tests. It really comes down to we will provide you with the resource of information based on the science, based on health committee recommendations. But ultimately, it's up to the individual breeder, pet parent, or veterinarian to decide what's important for their particular dog or line of dogs that they're looking at. Because if you know that, you know, a certain line is clear by parentage, then you might not need certain tests for that breed. So again, it all comes back to our goal of we want to make this as accessible for everyone as possible so that better decisions can lead to better health for dogs.
Yeah, absolutely. A couple follow-ups on that. This is really interesting. I think in terms of your educational and professional experience, I don't know if that was always within the animal space. Have you found it difficult relating to the limitations within research done in animals? And, you know, the importance that's held on that, and kind of, do you feel restricted at all by that and what we have at our fingertips?
Yeah, there is some limitations. I mean, things have come a long way since the sequencing of the dog genome. And dogs act as a great model for human disease, because dogs suffer from similar or the same disease as we do, and sometimes for the same mutations within the same genes. So they act as a great model. I think the thing that's limited or sort of missing is most of the research studies have a limited N number of dogs, so they only look at a certain number of breeds. What's really needed is follow-on tracking of what's the health of these animals. So we can tell you whether a mutation is there. Does it have 0, 1, or 2 copies of that mutation? But really, we rely on that original research to tell us, you know, will there be a disease progression? And the original research is typically limited just because, you know, one research study can take years to do, and it's really hard to accumulate the numbers within a breed, let alone across breeds, to say, well, what is the actual health impact of this actual mutation? Because we test for certain things. Degenerative myelopathy is a good example where that mutation is found across many breeds. It's actually a more ancient mutation that happened way back before dogs started splitting off into different breeds. And it strangely can be found in certain breeds in a very high frequency, but none of those dogs ever seem to show symptoms. And again, I think this is still a question that's trying to be answered, and it could be due to a complex genetic background, environment, combinations of the two. But really, it's about, like I said, getting back to the point of tracking the health in these breeds to make sure that what actually happens to these dogs later in life, because that's a disease that won't show up until, you know, 8, 10, even 12 years old. And it can also be difficult to fully diagnose as well. That's the other part of the equation, is good pathology, good diagnostics on that end, besides the molecular, to say, well, does this dog actually have this disease? Because if we go back to the degenerative myelopathy example, lots of other things can present very much like DM. But the only true way to diagnose it is through pathology postmortem. I mean, you have to look at the spinal cord, you need to stain. And that's just not done enough to fully, you know, make a conclusive diagnosis and then take that step to connect it back to the mutation. So yeah, if you combine all that information, then you'd have a much, much, much better understanding of what's going on in all these breeds. And we see this with tons of mutations where they just happen to be in other breeds, but they're not the causative mutation in that breed. So
yeah, it's a piece of the puzzle, and I think you need to look at it full big picture. And we have so many, especially with those complicated conditions, where it's not as easy as, oh, two copies means, you know, clinical manifestation. And yeah. I think that causes a lot of confusion. People go online, they research or they discuss with somebody, and they, you know, when you read about degenerative myelopathy, obviously that becomes a very scary conversation. But I think, to your point, it doesn't necessarily always mean that there'll be clinical manifestation. You touched on crossbreeds. I think that's a really interesting topic. How do you guys handle when there, say there isn't the research behind it? All different kinds of crossbreeds are coming out now, people interested in doing different things. How do you handle those results and, you know, educating or instructing people depending on what they present to you on what they're interested in breeding?
Our best guidance typically on that, on crossbreeds, or, you know, I think they're also referred to as designer breeds, is you need to look at what breeds went into that designer breed, and there is the potential to have the mutations for whatever breed. So if we're talking about like a labradoodle, you know, you need to be thinking about a Labrador, you need to be thinking about a poodle. You know, anything that went into making that breed could have pulled in that mutation from that breed. So our typical recommendation is, if you want to cover all your bases, you need to test across those breeds.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a good point to be, you know, conservative in that approach. I think a lot of people maybe think of hybrid vigor and think, oh, we're doing this across and we're going to make things better and we're not looking at these issues. But I think it may even introduce more problems. You need to keep that in mind.
Yes, it can. It can. And that's something I think there's a little misconception about. That, I mean, hybrid vigor, you know, that's true in some situations, but yeah, it's not necessarily in this case.
Yeah, exactly. You also touched briefly on clear by parentage. I was wondering, we have a lot of questions on that. We have a policy for our platform on that as well. I think there's often confusion around, you know, what that means. And we have a lot of people, oh, my parents were tested for maybe a phenotypic issue, and so the offspring will be fine. I was wondering if you could elaborate on that and just kind of clarify.
I think there's three major things to be concerned about or to think about when it comes to clear by parentage, which honestly, nowadays, it's so inexpensive at this point. We recommend to people just test. You know, you can be sure, but, you know, the ultimate proof is I tested these puppies and here's the result. But with that said, I mean, for true clear by parentage, you need to not only have the genetic mutation information from both parents, but you also have to prove parentage in each puppy. And by the time you're done doing that, you've already probably gone over the cost of just doing the puppy. So again, that's why we recommend that. The other issue, and I hate to say this, but we've seen this a few times where not everybody's truthful, you know, results can change depending on whose hands they go through. And you just need to be careful. We have people that will take word of mouth. There's some scrupulous stuff out there that people need to be a little careful of, which again gets back to just do the simple thing and just test the litter. And make sure you do it. We do see cases where someone will say, well, but I was told this dog was tested and this is what they were. You know, typically it's a pet parent coming back to us that maybe got a result from a breeder. And just to be sure, we do see cases where, you know, you might have 5, 6, 10 puppies on the ground. You're trying to keep track of what swab is going in what puppy's mouth and trying to track all that. And nobody's perfect and accidents happen. And, you know, it might not be till years later that somebody figures out, well, something wasn't what I thought it was. So just being careful about that and knowing how to properly do clear by parentage is important, you know, if you really want to get the full picture.
No, it definitely is. Reference testing puppies. We've had a lot of questions relating to that, you know, breeders reaching out. What is the benefit of doing this if I'm not going to be breeding those dogs? I am placing them in the home. I think you've referenced, you know, this knowledge can be very helpful to inform a veterinarian, your case in Dexter, maybe, you know, lifestyle changes or what have you. I was wondering if you could expand on that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, even if these are going to pet parents, I mean, you're not going to use them as breeding stock. Some things to think about, some of the stuff that we test for can be helped by changes in diet. You need to be careful. Certain mutations we test for, you know, too high fat diet, you can too high copper. I mean, certain things, you know, when these dogs have these mutations can create the issue. But if you know ahead of time and you can adjust their diet, chances are you'll never see the effect of the mutation. So that helps pet parents plan for the future of that dog. In addition to, as I mentioned, some of these diseases, unfortunately, there is no cure. There is no treatment. But just knowing what's coming down the line for a pet parent can save a lot of grief, you know, can basically help them plan for that. Some of the things like, you know, if you have a dog, which unfortunately there's lots of mutations that hit dogs in the eye. PRA or progressive retinal atrophy is very common, and there's lots of different mutations. Many of them are breed specific. So we do get a lot of confusion because someone will say, well, I want a PRA test. Well, there is no PRA test. You need to be very specific about which one, because lots of dogs will test very clear for some of those PRA mutations if you don't test for the right one. But just knowing that, you can plan ahead for how to deal with a blind dog, degenerative myelopathy, how to deal with a dog that's going to start losing the ability to walk. You know, there's wheelchairs. There's things you can do to better their quality of life, knowing what's coming. And just being a pet parent, knowing what you're getting. And I think pet parents in general have become much more educated about this. They understand what this is. And lots of the pet parents we're contacted by will say, well, we made this mandatory. You know, we wouldn't accept a puppy without these types of results. And it's just better for everybody. It just creates a better situation moving forward. And then if you're going to use them for breeding stock, obviously you really do need to know, you know, what dam and sires you're putting together, and just be knowledgeable about what you can get. It shouldn't dictate exactly who you breed together, because, you know, there are cases we were actually going to use Dexter as a breeding dog. We chose not to move forward with that. But if you breed a dog that's affected to a clear dog, you know, with a recessive disease, none of the puppies will have the disease. So just knowing that and keeping that in mind is important. So really, the information is the power.
It definitely is. You were touching at the end of that on breeding decisions and basing them on genetic test results. I was wondering if we could, you know, make that a larger conversation. I think that's probably why
I think that one a little bit.
We'll be tuning in, and I think, you know, they'll definitely find it interesting. And like I mentioned before, I think there's still a lot of confusion surrounding this, whether it be on the too conservative side. You know, good luck finding a perfect, you know, air quote dog, if you will.
And there is none. Yep.
Also, not necessarily prudent to only be breeding those if you find a relatively perfect dog, but also, you know, we should definitely be taking caution. And some things, like you mentioned with Dexter, probably in a perfect world would be avoiding breeding certain animals. So I was wondering if you could speak to that.
Yeah. When we're contacted by breeders concerning, you know, breeding probabilities and who should I put together, we don't tell people who to breed and who not to breed. We just tell them what the outcomes are. So our first step is just to educate people on, you know, when you put two dogs together, what could you possibly see? Because in some cases, you know the outcome. So if you breed, let's say, a clear dog to an affected dog, which just for terminology, that means a dog that has no copies of the mutation is clear, to a dog that has two copies of the mutation that's affected. In that case, every dog's going to be a carrier. And for every time, all the time, assuming that those parents are correct. And if it's a recessive disease, and none of those puppies are going to suffer from the disease, they'll only have one copy of the mutation. There are other situations and other breeding combinations where it comes down to probability, which probability can be sometimes a difficult topic for folks to understand. So one way we help people do that is we sort of translate it down. We'll usually use an example of flipping a quarter. It helps people kind of understand what probability is, because sometimes we'll get situations where a breeder will contact us and say, well, there's no way these results are correct because I bred these two together, and by probability, here's what I should get. But we try to help them understand that, you know, if you take a quarter and you flip it once, you have a 50% chance of getting heads. Flip it twice, and you now have 50% times 50% chance of getting heads, which is a lower probability, but it's not zero. And you could flip a quarter 100 times, and it's an extremely low probability, but you can get heads 100 times. So in the case of breeding dogs, you know, sometimes we'll get situations where if you breed a carrier to a carrier, you should be able to, you know, by probability, get a quarter of the litter, you know, would be clear, a quarter would be affected, and half would carry the mutation. But the reality is you can see any combination in there, because the way this works is every sperm and egg has one copy of the gene. And in a dog that's a carrier, it just depends on what sperm or egg meets up. And a better understanding of probability helps folks get this and Punnett squares and sort of figuring out what are my possible results here. And then once you know that, the decision above that is, well, okay, you know, there are other things involved with breeding besides disease, things like temperament, You don't want to bottleneck the population by trying to completely breed away from a mutation because you're going to lose some of the things that make that breed. It's a complex decision. And at the end of the day, we just try and provide the information and guidance for people to help them make that decision. Because like I said, we didn't breed Dexter, but there's no reason another breeder couldn't have. I mean, he had other really great qualities that we would have loved to pass on, but we just didn't want to take the chance at the time. So.
No, sure. I think people have different risk tolerances. And so just the more information you have, I think the better chance you have to make a decision that you're the most comfortable with. Was wondering, in some of those diseases where it's not as straightforward as at risk or affected.
Not as black and white.
Yes, exactly. I was wondering if you could kind of delve into that. I think, you know, IVDD, DM, I know you spoke at length about. I think those are the types of conditions that I think breeders have the most difficulty with in understanding the results and understanding how to move forward. I know we touched on clinical manifestation, what have you, and kind of, once again, this is a puzzle piece utilizing your whole team, veterinarians, scientists relating to the test, but I was wondering if you could touch on that.
Yeah, the genetic testing part is a good starting place. Like you mentioned, I mean, there's certain mutations we test for where there just hasn't been a dog that's, you know, depending on whether it's recessive or dominant, that, you know, hasn't had the mutation that doesn't suffer from the disease. Unfortunately, that's the rare case. Most of the mutations we test for, like IVDD, DM, I mean, there's a ton of them. It's just more complicated than that. Genetics, biology, we're not as simple as change this and here's the result, because, you know, how life works, how our biology works is very complex. So, like, if we take the case of IVDD, which also can present itself similar to other things like injury and other things, which can make a diagnosis very difficult. Some of these tests are more risk-based tests, which means that if the mutation is present, that dog has a higher risk of the disease, but it's not a guarantee. And different dogs can present differently with the exact same mutation, even within the same breed. So that is a case where having the information up front allows you to go to your veterinarian and say, well, here's what I got. What can we do to keep an eye on this to make sure that if this progresses, at least we know beforehand, you know, what we're dealing with. We've had cases where we've actually had personal friends that they didn't even know what we do. And they had a dog that was presenting with symptoms and they started explaining it to us and sounded just like DM. And they had gone through a lot of expensive testing and they were looking for other causes. And we said, well, you know, just order this quick test real fast for $40. And unfortunately, you know, some of the time it has turned out to be DM, but at least gave them the answer as to what it was. It was an injury. It wasn't, you know, another cause. So just by knowing makes a big difference. It doesn't mean that these mutations, you know, some of them, like I said, it's, you know, you're going to get what you get every time, but lots of these, you need to be aware that it's more risk and know where you're going with it.
Yeah, it's very helpful. And I think even in some breeds, there are conditions that are fixed where you're not going to find one that doesn't have that. I was wondering if you could touch on that, because I think a lot of people, I wouldn't say necessarily breeders, but people that are searching for a new pup will see the results, start researching on their own, come back and say, oh my goodness, you know, I don't feel comfortable, or this may be a mistake. But when you're looking at that breed, you know, yes, to your point, there is risk, but it's, if you're interested in like that breed, that's probably what you're working with.
Yeah. And I mean, probably one of the examples that comes to mind is hyperuricosuria and Dalmatians, or HU. Unfortunately, that mutation was solidified in that breed. So there was a back cross project, you know, which not everybody agrees with, but where essentially they were trying to breed in some clear copies of the gene into the breed to help alleviate this. But for the most part, almost any Dalmatian you test that's not part of that is going to have two copies from the mutation and suffers from urinary stones. So it's just part of having a Dalmatian, unfortunately, that was just solidified in that breed. And there's a few other examples, but just knowing that, like you said, you know what you're getting into, you know what's involved. So that's an important piece of information to know.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there anything thus far that we haven't touched on that you'd really want people to be aware of, whether it relates to, you know, genetic testing in general or GenSol? I definitely want people to receive all the information they can.
If people have questions, you know, we're always available to talk about it. We just hope people understand what a really valuable tool this is for breeders, for pet parents, for veterinarians. You can significantly alter the life of a dog just by knowing this information. There's one mutation we haven't touched on that, you know, really, well, it's important for pet parents and breeders, but really veterinarians. As a veterinarian, did you ever hear white feet don't treat as a saying?
I haven't.
Basically, it's the herding breed suffer from a mutation called MDR1. And that was for the longest time, veterinarians didn't know what it was, but they just knew. And really what it is if you use too high of a level of medication, whether it's tick or flea and tick or anesthetic, you can cause seizures and essentially these dogs can die. And unfortunately, the mutation is very prevalent in herding breeds, which just happen to normally have white feet. So vets for the longest time before that mutation was found were going by that saying to help them understand, well, be careful with these. We don't know why, but so nowadays you can test for that mutation. So we have a lot of vets that will contact us for information regarding, well, you know, I know that this dog is an MDR1 dog and what should we be doing? You know, how should we handle this? And there's a lot of good information out there and it saved a lot of dogs' lives. That's another mutation where we've had personal experience with other people that unfortunately they didn't know. And, you know, the consequences were not great.
Yeah, unfortunately, all it takes is one experience, particularly with that. You're talking about anesthetic or what have you. If they go in for, you know, their first procedure, spay and neuter or something like that, and you're faced with that, I mean, it could definitely have unpleasant repercussions. I love your point. I mean, I think now there isn't an excuse not to pursue this testing. The cost you touched on, the availability, the return you get in terms of the expediency. I think, you know, it's something that everybody should be doing. And I think also to your point, well, I have these results. I don't necessarily know what to do with it. I'm happy to hear that, Gensol, you guys are always there to educate and instruct and inform. I think, you know, it doesn't do a lot of good if you have these results, if you don't know what to do with them. So I'm so happy to be working with you guys. I mean, to hear, you know, this story, really, really interesting. And we so much appreciate the time you spent with us.
We appreciate what you guys are doing. You guys have a very similar approach, which is, you know, the more you can educate, the more you can help people understand this, because I mean, genetics can be a somewhat complicated topic, but, you know, there's no reason that people can't understand it to be able to use it as a tool to make better decisions, you know, when it comes to breeding, healthcare. So yeah, you guys are doing valuable thing by educating people on this. So we appreciate what you guys are doing too.
It's very nice of you. Yeah. I definitely makes a difference. And I think, you know, to your point, the awareness and education surrounding this, I'm so happy to hear that more and more people that are interested in puppies are knowledgeable, at least about it to a certain extent, and can look into it and ask the appropriate questions to gain the knowledge that they might need. I think that's all we've got for today. Thank you so much for taking the time to tune into this week's episode. We'd like to thank again, Dr. Halpert and Gensol, for your time and willingness to educate our community on this podcast. We certainly hope this information was helpful. We appreciate you tuning in, and we'll see you back here for our next episode.
Thanks, Nate.
Thank you for listening to the Good Dog Pod. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode, so be sure to subscribe to the Good Dog Pod on your favorite podcast platform.